Young black men are 21 times more likely to be killed by police than their white counterparts. The unemployment rate for African Americans has been double that of whites for more than half a century. And yet, Americans cling desperately to the myth that we are living in a post-racial society, that the election of the first black president spelled doom for racist policies and racist beliefs. In fact, racist thought is alive and well in America. It has simply become more sophisticated and more insidious. And as award-winning historian Ibram Kendi argues in his book Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America, if we have any hope of grappling with this stark reality, we must first understand how racist ideas were developed, disseminated, and enshrined in American society. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
What brought you to want to compile a definitive history?
I think two reasons. First, this type of book has never been written, and so we think it's the first book to chronicle the entire history of racist ideas from their origins to the present. And then secondly, I think within this current racial climate in which people are searching for answers to the problems that still plague America, I think the history of racist ideas, the history of racism, can provide solutions to many of these problems that we're facing.
You narrate this history through the lives of five major characters in American history. These include Cotton Mather, Thomas Jefferson, William Lloyd Garrison, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Angela Davis. Why these five individuals, and how did they allow you to ultimately tell this story?
Well, each of these five individuals were really at the center of racial debates during their time periods, really at the center of debates between racists. And so I chronicled two types of racist ideas in the book. Or they were also at the center of debates between racist ideas and anti-racist ideas. And their lifetimes, you know, spans critical sort of times in American history. So from early America being Cotton Mather to the first 50 years of the United States and Thomas Jefferson, the period of covering the decades leading up to the Civil War, up until the end of Reconstruction and Garrison, and then the time period from the end of Reconstruction to Civil Rights, and W.E.B. Du Bois, and then the last 50 years and Angela Davis. So their lives sort of, I think, bookend critical periods in American history. And I think we're able to sort of see the life of racist ideas through their lives, through their ideas. And so they sort of serve as tour guides. And I really wanted to make this book as accessible as possible so it can read as quickly as possible and it could be as simple as possible for as many people as possible to understand.
As you said a moment ago, you chronicle two types of racial ideas in the book. And I'm curious as to what those two ideas are, with the precursor, perhaps, of how you identify and how you define a racial idea.
Sure. So that's one of the more controversial aspects of really writing about racism. Of course, drawing that line between what's racism and what's not. And so what I drew the line was, I basically stated that any idea that suggests that any racial group is superior or inferior in any way to another racial group is a racist idea. And so that's the definition I sort of provided. And so typically you've had two types of racist ideas. So one type has stated that black people are biologically inferior and thereby permanently inferior. And then another group of racist ideas has stated that, no, the racial groups are equal, but black people are behaviorally inferior. And so they have come to become inferior. So one is more of a nature argument and the other is more of a nurture argument. But both arguments end in black people being inferior.
You also, you make the point in the book that these ideas were not necessarily, and in most cases, did not come from ignorance or hatred, but were often devised by some of the most brilliant minds of the era.
Yeah, that was one of the most unfortunate findings, but I think it's also very revealing to sort of how we address racist ideas today. And that is, I entered into this research project assuming, like I'm sure many people do, that racist ideas, that people who were expressing racist ideas were expressing them because they were ignorant and hateful. And one of the things that I found is, first of all, I tried to differentiate between the producers of racist ideas, these brilliant American minds who've been novelists, who've been presidents, who've been filmmakers, who've been scholars, these brilliant minds, these brilliant creators, and consumers. So the masses of Americans, you know, you and I and others. And so the book really tracks those producers of racist ideas and really tries to understand why did they produce those ideas. And I found that over and over again that they were producing them to defend existing racist policies. They were producing them to normalize and rationalize racial disparities, to tell us that it's normal that black people are enslaved, or it's normal that black people are segregated in that other neighborhood, to convince us that it's normal that black people should be incarcerated by the millions because they're so dangerous.
So the motive was to protect the ideas that were already entrenched and thereby dictating the discussion on race for some 400 years.
Precisely. And so it's as simple as, if you look at racial disparities, you take a disparity like over the last 50 years, the black unemployment rate has been twice as high as the white unemployment rate. There's only three explanations. There's something wrong with black people, meaning they're lazy, they don't want to get jobs, they're not qualified. All of these ideas that target black people, that in some ways say that black people are inferior. Another position is that it's the result of racial discrimination. And then a third position argues both, that yes, black people are lazy, unqualified, and all these things, but then there is also racial discrimination. And really, those three sides have been debating across American history, and those sides who were insinuating that black people are at fault were typically those who were discriminating against black people in the job market, right? And so they wanted to maintain that ability.
The name of the new book is Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. The author is Ibram Kendi, our guest this morning. You point out that these racist ideas are easily produced and easily consumed, but also easily discredited. With that easy discreditation, why does that not allow them to be erased?
Because over the course of history, as racist ideas have been discredited by a number of Americans, they've been constantly been produced. And so as we've been discrediting ideas, those who need these ideas to justify whatever racist policies they have in place have constantly been producing them. And so when we discredited that America was not a colorblind society, then you had the idea of a post-racial society. When we discredited the idea that we're not living in a post-racial society, then you had people articulating ideas like, well, we need to stop being politically correct and talk about black people in the way that they truly are. And so, you know, there's this constant reproduction of ideas. And that's why even when we, you know, eliminate them or discredit them, new ones constantly, you know, emerge.
So that idea that these ideas did not arise from ignorance or hatred, they are often propelled and returned to the forefront through ignorance and hatred.
Precisely. And so we, of course, consume them, and then it makes us ignorant, right? It makes us, if we consume this idea that, to go back to the earlier discussion about unemployment, that black people are more likely to be unemployed because they're lazy, then we reproduce that idea and tell other people that idea, and then we're saying now ignorant ideas, because of course the reality is discrimination as to the reasons why there are these disparities. And so that's why racist ideas have actually led to ignorance and hate and not the other way around.
You spoke a moment ago of this post-racial society, which is something that came out, especially after the election of Barack Obama as president of the United States. How do you envision that it would have been different had he not been elected? Would we still have been having that conversation in some form?
I think in some form we were already having it with the argument of color blindness, which of course emerged around 1997, around the time when President Clinton started to lead a national conversation on race, and you had the opponent saying, no, we don't need this conversation, we're a colorblind society. And so we were sort of already having that discussion over the previous 10 years. But I think what changed is you had individuals who were like, how can we leverage this election of Obama to get people to think that black people are to blame for these disparities and not racial discrimination? And I think they came up with the post-racial idea.
And where do we stand now with that post-racial idea?
I think you, of course, have some people who look upon the continued shootings of unarmed black people as black people's fault. You have people who look at the rhetoric of politicians and say they're speaking, the racist rhetoric of politicians, and say that they're speaking the truth. But I think more and more fair-minded Americans, as a result of these shootings, as a result of the teachings of Black Lives Matter activists, as a result of even this campaign, have begun to realize that we're not living in a post-racial society. We're not even close to living in a post-racial society.
What opportunities do you think we have right now to, once again, as you say, these racist ideas are easily produced, they are easily consumed, but they are also easily discredited. Do we have an opportunity right now to discredit those ideas to move forward where they do not return in another form?
I think so. And I try to, you know, even though I'm writing about a very difficult topic, obviously, the book not only discusses racist ideas, but it discusses anti-racist ideas and those anti-racist Americans of all races who've constantly been challenging these ideas. And it even ends talking about the people who are trying to challenge them today. So I think we have that opportunity. We've always had that opportunity. But we have to recognize that these ideas are actually more or less propaganda, and they're coming out of the efforts to defend these policies. And so we really need to focus on the policies, and we really need to focus on eliminating the disparities. And I think if we're able to eliminate the disparities and the policies, then their PR machine, racist ideas, will be eliminated too.
You write right at the end of the book, protesting racist policies can never be a long-term solution to eradicating racial discrimination and thus racist ideas in America. Just as one generation of powerful Americans could decide or be pressured by protest to end racial discrimination, when the conditions and interests change, another generation could once again encourage racial discrimination. That's why protesting against racist power has been a never-ending affair in America. So my question to you is then, but it still has to be protested, correct?
Yes. And so I guess what I'm talking about in that part is that you can protest against racist power, right? But the key is to gain power. And so that's why this whole issue of race, just like gender and other issues, has really been a power struggle. And trying to get people who have an anti-racist perspective, who truly look out at the groups as equal, and then in looking out at those groups as equal, when there's disparities in their institutions, they don't blame specific groups. They look at the institutions themselves. It's trying to get those particular types of people in positions of power and then not only have those people in positions of power, ensure that they are being held up and defended and supported by other anti-racists. And so I think that's really the point, you know, that I was sort of trying to make, that it's really about gaining power, because that's really the only way we can really ensure that we have an anti-racist society, that we have anti-racist people leading it.
Ibram Kendi is an assistant professor of African American history at the University at Florida and is the author of the new book Stamped from the Beginning and is our guest this morning. That idea that we want to have an anti-racist society, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, there are many people who actually believe, and I actually talk about this as well in the epilogue, there are many people who believe that in a truly anti-racist society will actually not be beneficial to them. So, for instance, some white Americans believe that if we were to truly have an anti-racist society, that they would lose. When we look at American history, we see that the times in which America has been the most egalitarian racially, they've also been egalitarian in almost every other facet, and, you know, as it relates to class and gender. And so, you know, really to create an egalitarian America is not only going to be beneficial for black people, it's going to be beneficial for middle-income and working-class white Americans who've lost their wages over the last 30 years, because it's not a coincidence that at the same time you've had this racist reactionary movement against black people, you've had this reactionary movement against the wages and incomes and livelihoods of working and middle-income people.
Why do, and I apologize if I'm bringing this to a different level, but I'm just,
oh, no.
I'm just curious as to, you know, you just have to help me through this.
Sure.
And that is, you have somebody like Carl Paladino who's introducing Donald Trump and talks about raccoons in the basement and then mm-hmm. says that that's not a racist term. How do we work through that as a society and have that not, I mean, we on one hand can just look at it and say, okay, that's just stupidity. And then we can also look at it and say, okay, but that's much deeper and something that we have to take seriously.
It is. I think it is something we have to take seriously. And I'm happy you bring this up, because I think the way that we take it seriously is to understand that there is a long history of people who articulate racist statements denying that they are racist. And so, you know, of course we have most people are understand that almost every major American racist today denies that they're racist. There's a long history to that. Slaveholders argued that they were not, when they were stating statements about black people being natural slaves, they said, no, we're articulating God's law. We're articulating nature's law. We're articulating the truth. We're not prejudiced. You know, this is the truth. This is reality. And so did segregationists. And so there's a long history of people articulating these racist ideas and then turn around and denying that they're racist. And so we should, if anything, expect that they're going to do that and recognize and expect that because we have that history, that historical base.
Then are you encouraged at all? This book is exhaustive. This book is so beautifully written, and it is one of the breeziest books that I have ever read that is, like, what, 700 pages or whatever? So I'm interested in whether you feel that you come out of this project and this idea feeling that you have some optimism.
Yeah, I actually am quite optimistic. I'm optimistic because I think any American who's truly committed to change has to be optimistic. I mean, you just have to be, you know, and I understand that philosophically. That once I become pessimistic as a writer, once I become pessimistic as an American trying to make this place into an anti-racist America, into an anti-sexist America, you know, into an America that's truly egalitarian and have equal opportunities for all, that once I believe that that's not possible, it fundamentally will never become possible, right? Because it's those people themselves who want to create that before anyone else have to believe that it's possible. And I think we have history, we have so many achievements in American history that should give us the ability to think that it's possible. But we also have to recognize the ways in which you've had anti-racist activists who tried to create equal opportunity, but you've constantly also had racist activists who were constantly trying to limit equal opportunity, and that American history has had both types of histories who've been constantly struggling. And so we have to constantly struggle for the America we want to create.
Will, the book is outstanding and such an accomplished and amazing history. It is entitled Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. It is published by Nation Books. Ibram Kendi, I thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. A great pleasure having you on the program.
It was truly my pleasure and honor, Joe. You take care. Thank you so much for those questions.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Stamped from the Beginning, published by Nation Books by Ibram Kendi. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.